Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. As we mentioned earlier in the show, Governor Christie's inauguration for his second term is today, and Cranes describes interest in the event as muted, plus the tone of the event as muted, plus a dinner that was supposed to be held for some of Christie's closest supporters last night was canceled. And Crane says Republicans have had more tickets to give away for his events than they did 4 years ago for Inauguration One. This is also reported in Metropolis magazine. So are Christie's presidential plans falling apart as each day seems to bring a new scandal? We'll talk about that and more with Jonathan Chait, daily columnist for New York Magazine. Hey, Jonathan, welcome back to WNYC. Jonathan Chait, can you hear me? I think you can hear me, but I can't hear you. Let's see if we can fix that. Listeners, do you read Jonathan Chait? You want to call in on some of his stuff? He's been writing very opinionated columns about Chris Christie. Calling him corrupt just goes right to the word. And predicting that his 2016 presidential aspirations are already doomed. So we'll get that political analysis from Jonathan Chait as soon as we get him up. Jonathan, do we have you now? Not quite. He's also been writing about the Affordable Care Act rollout and how back before, well, some of the things that Marco Rubio, for example, is saying that there's an Obamacare bailout in the bill that may save the law from bankruptcy this week, which is not really a bailout per se, but what they call a risk corridor. As Chait wrote in one of his pieces recently, the way it works is that companies that wind up with unexpectedly healthy customers pay some of their insurance profit windfall back to the government, and companies with unexpectedly sick customers get compensated for their losses. And that's an interesting detail, whether you're for the Affordable Care Act or against it, that there's a system of guarantees for insurance companies. Jonathan Chait, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yay, we have you now. How you doing? Okay. Thanks for coming on today.
Thanks. Yeah, I was hearing you the whole time. I don't know what happened.
So I don't know. Maybe we should jump in on the Obamacare thing that I was just talking about, the so-called Obamacare bailout that Marco Rubio has been talking about using that term. You want to kind of pick up where I left off and explain what that really is?
Right. Well, what a bailout is when a private corporation is able to privatize its gains and socialize its losses, right? They're able to take extraordinary and unusual risks, and if and when those risks don't pan out for them, the taxpayers are on the hook. So they get all the upside themselves, and the taxpayers have none of the downside. There's nothing in the Affordable Care Act that remotely approximates a bailout. What you have is a kind of risk corridor provision that was designed to prevent insurers from cherry-picking out the healthiest customers. The idea was to try to get them to compete, but to compete not by finding the healthiest and excluding the sickest people, but instead compete on offering the best quality, the best prices, the best choices of doctors and hospitals and providers and that sort of thing. And so the way it works is the insurance companies that end up with sicker-than-expected customers get more money back from the government, and those who end up with healthier-than-expected customers pay more money back to the government, right? So this is a key thing because there's no upside for you in getting healthier-than-expected customers.
So it's like a windfall profits tax?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It's like if you get the windfall profit of having healthier than expected customers, then you give that back to the government. So it's to reduce your incentive to skim out the healthy.
So Marco Rubio is trying to frame that as a bailout of the government by the insurance companies. Is that right?
No, by the government of the insurance companies.
Oh, by helping the insurance companies who have the less healthy populations.
Right. So you had the busted website for the first 2 months of what's a fixed amount of time to enroll in these exchanges, right? Mm-hmm. So that screwed everything up to some extent. They're going to have fewer customers than they hope for, and it's likely, although it's not certain, that the customer base is going to skew somewhat different than what they expected. So it's entirely possible that the customer pool for the first year, because of this busted website, is going to have fewer healthy people and more sick people, because usually what happens is the people who enroll first are the people who need the insurance most desperately, the people with pre-existing conditions.
The latest – go ahead, sorry.
So they're looking now, hypothetically at least, it's certainly possible then that this risk corridor program will end up paying money out on net, because more insurers will have sick customers than sicker than expected
right.
customers.
At least at the beginning, yeah.
Right, in the first year. So go on.
Well, do you like that program?
Yeah, I mean, no one objected to it when the law was written. No one discovered it for the first 3.5 years since the law was written. In fact, it only lasts for 3 years, and there's a program like that in Medicare Part D. That's the prescription drug benefit that the Bush administration passed, which is unlike the Obamacare version, which lasts for 3 years and then ends. The Bush version lasts forever in perpetuity. It's been going on for more than 10 years, and no one has complained about it. So the idea that this is some outrageous new bailout is just a piece of extraordinary demagoguery.
Now, the latest stats that I read on who's actually signing up for policies on these exchanges in the Wall Street Journal the other day is that it's not a lot of uninsured people, that most of the people actually buying Affordable Care Act policies are people who have had health insurance as individuals or in some other ways, and they're switching over to the exchanges because they find them advantageous. But, of course, the goal of the Affordable Care Act, besides to bend the cost curve and bring down the insanely spiraling cost of health care overall in America, is to cover the uninsured. But
right.
So far, if the journal's got it right, we're not covering the uninsured very well.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's a study. It's a data point. I wouldn't discount it. I wouldn't take it as gospel either, because it's a survey based on a somewhat small number of data points that they don't have all the people signed up. They sort of did a survey with a sample size that some people think is a little bit low, but it may be true. And if that's true, that they're not extending coverage, at least in the initial month, I think it only went through December. They stopped the survey in December. That would certainly show that they had done a slower-than-expected job of extending coverage to the uninsured, that they've just switched people over. On the other hand, the flip side of that is this idea that it's going to be a death spiral, that it won't have a sound risk pool of healthy and sick people, is also probably not true, because if you're attracting people who already had insurance, that means people who weren't excluded from having pre-existing conditions. So these are two different fears
right.
that are somewhat mutually exclusive.
And one thing that we have to say whenever we talk about things like this is that it's so early. So assuming the federal government has enough money and the insurance companies have enough money to go through a little bit of a rollout period where things, launch and get settled out, we really can't know until probably a year or two from now whether this is going to serve to get a lot of uninsured people signed up, whether this is going to have a balance of younger, healthier, and older, sicker people that would work to keep the premiums affordable, and those fundamental financial questions.
Right. Well, we know about the premiums. The premiums are established, and then they're going to have the premiums posted for next year in the fall. So then we'll have some real information about what's the premium level. The premiums for the first year came in well below expectations. They came in about 20% on average lower than forecast. So the premiums for the first year are good. We'll see if the premiums rise much, if at all, for the second year. We'll know that in the fall.
Jonathan Chait, New York Magazine columnist, my guest on WNYC. 212-433-WNYC. If you want to talk to him, maybe you read Jonathan Chait on New York Magazine's website every day. Maybe he's in your daily feed of one sort or another, or just want to react to what he's saying. 212-433-9692. Let's go back to Christie, on whom you have predicted that he's already doomed for 2016, correct?
Right.
Why?
Right. So I think he has a mix of personal and ideological problems that's going to make it extremely difficult for him to get the Republican nomination. the ideological problems, I think, are a little bit underappreciated. He's one of the few Republican governors who agreed to take Medicaid funding, to expand Medicaid to cover the uninsured under the Affordable Care Act. That is essentially makes him a traitor in the war against Obamacare as far as Republicans are concerned. He's also said things about issues like gun control that are going to put him crossways with certain conservatives. So I think there's this pre-existing ideological vulnerability where conservatives can say, can we trust this guy? Is he one of us? So when I think when you come in and add the scandals, and I think there's a pretty wide number of them. Not all of them are going to pan out, but there's such a large number that I think, you know, it's just going to create this constant aura of scandal and questions about how he's governed. And I think when you add in the fact that the Republican Party is disproportionately Southern and more Midwestern to a lesser extent and not based so much in the Northeast, and there's a I think deeper than appreciated cultural distrust of New York, New Jersey, and the Northeast that bit Giuliani a bit when he tried to run for president. And I think he's also going to play into both of those issues. So I think all these three problems, this regional, ideological, and personal problem, I think they're all interrelated.
But I'm confused, honestly, yeah. about the role of that, you know, Southern conservative, Western conservative ideology in Republican presidential primaries at this point, because, as you know, we all had the same conversations in 2008 and in 2012. And what did they do, ultimately, all these Republican primary voters? They went ahead and nominated the moderates, John McCain in 2008 and Mitt Romney, yeah. who, of course, had been the moderate governor of Massachusetts last year or in 2012. So I don't know how much of a lock the true right has on Republican primary nominations.
So you're absolutely right about that, and I think there's an appropriate caution that politics is unpredictable, and there's this element of pinballs where one event leads to another, so that you can end up in a place that you never imagined, where one candidate collapses, which suddenly creates a vacuum for another candidate, and there's a bit of a chaos theory going on. So you have to always say that when you're making a prediction about elections that are happening a few years from now, there's got to be an attached caveat. We don't really know. So that sort of implied asterisk has to be to anything I'm trying to predict is playing out. So it's not like analyzing something we know about right now. You're guessing to a large extent. That said, what I've tried to argue is that Christie is in much worse shape than people think. I've been saying that for a while. And I think the breadth of the scandals around him not only is going to create a constant narrative of investigations and problems, but I think it simply increases the likelihood that some of them are going to hit pay dirt. There are all these questions being raised because I think there are legitimate questions about the way he carries himself in governance. I don't think he's particularly clean.
And there's such a big difference between the Fort Lee story and the Hoboken story. The Fort Lee yeah. story reinforces a narrative that was already part of the Christie story. He's a little bit of a bully. You know, he throws his weight around politically. I'm not interested in the fat jokes. He throws his weight around politically and, you know, the way he confronts people on videos and all of that stuff. Right. Okay, we knew that about Christie. If the Fort Lee lane closures were over the top, maybe he's got a lot of plausibility to say he didn't know about it. Maybe he really didn't know about it. Maybe he gets over that. The things from Mayor Zimmer and Hoboken are of a completely different nature, because if that's true, and we don't know, but if that's true, then that really is old-fashioned New Jersey corruption. If that's really Christie intervening with a mayor to get a development project done on behalf of a Christie ally who's, you know, a lawyer in a law firm that's going to make money from it, which is the charge, if that's true, then it's a whole other kind of Chris Christie than anybody ever thought he was.
That's interesting. I sort of thought of it as the reverse. The fact that they were so explicit about the fact that they were just closing this bridge to punish people, that there was no benefit, right? I mean, you can make an argument in favor of this development that they favored in Hoboken. So, you know, this is a dispute about policy. And then they use this incredibly blunt tool of withholding disaster aid to force the hand. But they were still trying to do something that you could argue was good policy. Whereas the bridge closure, I would say that just just harming people, and you can't have politicians who are just harming people just to be nasty and to punish politicians. That's insane.
Let's take a call. Bob in Stamford, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Brian. I just want to pass a comment along to your guest about the Affordable Care Act and his suggestion that premiums are somehow lower than expected or relatively low in the Affordable Care Act. My family has had individual insurance market here in Connecticut for the last 4 years, which we purchased from Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield. When we got the cancellation notice, our premiums went up by 2.66 times, or said another way, 166% increase, with a slight increase in deductible. And, you know, this notion that, well, we had a crummy plan. Well, I called the Connecticut Insurance Commissioner's office, and they said, no, in Connecticut there were no crummy plans because they had mandated minimal coverages. So just a fact from a real family, what's really happening to real people, and we don't qualify for any subsidies, is our premium gone up astronomically, okay? It's absolutely remarkable. And so what the insurance commissioner's office has told me is that here in Connecticut, at least, they've raised the premiums dramatically in expectations of having to cover a lot of sick people. And in the past, they could underwrite. They could selectively underwrite, and they can't anymore. So that's what's really happening in the real world to real people. And a lot of what I hear in the news is just nonsense.
And Jonathan, you know, and Bob, thank you very much. We've gotten similar stories from other callers. And I think one of the make or break aspects of the next few years for the Affordable Care Act is going to be whether the policies do turn out to be affordable enough that people are going to flock to them, including the uninsured, including the young and healthy, whether the subsidies are going to be enough for those who qualify for subsidies to make it look to people who haven't decided that they can afford insurance up until now to think that they actually can, whether there are too many stories like Bob's, and we've heard those before, and that's been part of the rollout problem, that some of the people who got bumped from their old plans because they were now deemed subpar under the new standards are going to have to pay a lot more. Just how much of that there is, right?
Yeah. So there's been a battle of anecdotes, and you have anecdotes by people. Both sides are really pushing to get their anecdotes out. You've got the opponents of the law pushing to get as many anecdotes into the public domain of someone who says, I'm paying much more. And you also have advocates of the law pushing out anecdotes of people saying, I'm paying so much less and getting so much more coverage than I could have gotten before. What I was doing was not using anecdotes, was simply describing on the aggregate, on the whole, the average of the premiums is 20% less than was forecast originally.
And boy, oh boy, we have a few calls like that. And just to acknowledge that we have 4 of our 10 lines taken up by people who have similar stories to the last caller. Let's talk to Haley in Manhattan, who's an MD. Yes, Haley?
Hi. I just wanted to say, first of all, I'm not paying more for my insurance. I'm paying about $150 less. I had sole proprietor insurance, which was excellent insurance, and now I have Blue Cross Blue Shield, and it's an inferior insurance. I don't have any out-of-network benefits, and the network that I have is very limited, but it's not as limited as what I would have gotten through the exchange. I went on the exchange, and I called the various insurance companies, and the networks, which I would get through either United or Blue Cross Blue Shield, were so limited that my doctors wouldn't take it. They said they took Blue Cross Blue Shield, but not through the exchange. So, and then on the exchange, the woman said to me, oh, the doctors are just going to start taking it. And as a physician, I know that I'm not going to start taking it. What I do is I lower my fee. And for patients who can't afford to pay my normal fee, I will lower my fee if they don't have insurance.
Why aren't you going to take the exchange plans?
Because the networks they offer, that if, let's say, Blue Cross Blue Shield, they offer, I'm not possibly not going to get the names right, but they offer something called the Pathway Network. And doctors don't take the Pathway Network. They take the Premium Network. So if you go and you say to the doctor, I have Blue Cross Blue Shield, they say, which Blue Cross Blue Shield do you have? And when you say, I have the Pathway Network, they say, we don't take that one because it reimburses for doctor visits at too low a rate. So the doctors just won't take that.
Haley, thank you very much.
I have one more thing I wanted to say.
Yep.
I have several patients in my practice who wanted to go through the exchange, but they can't afford the insurance through the exchange. They're not getting adequate subsidies so they can buy the insurance They're earning about $30,000, and it would cost them about $300 a month is what they've reported to me. So they're just going without insurance, and they're going to have to pay the penalty, I guess, at the end of the year, whenever that does start up, because they can't afford insurance through the exchange.
Is there anything as a physician that you would recommend? Is this system workable, basically, if they do some, you know, tweaks here and there?
What I recommended to my patients, the patients who can't afford it, all I can do is lower my fee for them, and I don't have advice for them. But for people who can afford insurance, who are in similar positions to the one I'm in, you go directly to the insurance company. Don't buy through the exchange, because the Blue Cross Blue Shield I ended up buying, I contacted Blue Cross Blue Shield directly. I'm paying about $150 less a month than I would have through the exchange, and I have a higher quality insurance. So if you contact at least Blue Cross Blue Shield, I know you can get a higher quality insurance, not through the exchange.
A higher quality insurance. But the exchanges have these standards now for what needs to be in a policy. That was supposed to be one of the major benefits, right?
Yeah, you still have the same standards. They can't offer you an insurance without those standards, as far as I know. But the Blue Cross Blue Shield I bought through Blue Cross Blue Shield offers me a better network of doctors.
Uh-huh.
It's the network. It's right. The doctors aren't going to take the exchange insurance because it reimburses it to lower rates. So if you go directly through Blue Cross Blue Shield, I don't know why, but I'm paying $420 for the insurance right now. And what I would have gotten through the exchange was about $570.
Per month?
Yeah, and it was a lower level insurance. Also, the insurance I had was $560, and it was excellent insurance with everything that I, you know, all the minimum requirements, but they don't, I mean, sole proprietors were cut out.
Haley, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate you chiming in on that. Well, the anecdotes continue. Jonathan, we just have a minute left. Jonathan Chait from New York Magazine, patiently standing by while I was talking to Dr. Haley. But I guess, you know, here on January 21st, the fate of Obamacare unresolved.
Right. So we have a huge differential in how different hospitals and different doctors charge. Some may charge 2, 3, 4, 10 times as much for one procedure than the other. And one of the things you've seen in the exchanges is that people want cheap plans. They want cheap insurance, and they're willing to get narrower networks that exclude the more expensive hospitals to get the cheapest possible insurance. That's one of the reasons why premiums are lower than forecast.
Jonathan Chait, daily columnist for New York Magazine. Thanks a lot.